Hello and welcome to a slightly delayed Under Common Taste. This is a... Jeez, I just threw myself way off.
Good job.
It's going to be amazing. Let's try that again. Hello and welcome to Under Common Taste. This is a podcast where we create and discuss homebrew content for tabletop RPGs.
The magi in my life have often surprised me. Many come with gifts of wisdom and acceptance. Some have come solely to kick me in the pants.
I'm Ian Woodworth. I'm joined by my co-host James Daly. We are ironing out some technical difficulties, but we have with us tonight a special guest, a returning special guest.
Woohoo.
Josh from Lone Colossus Games here to talk to us about his new book, The Tome of Intangible Treasures. Josh, welcome to Under Common Taste.
Good to be here.
Yes, thank you for showing up.
Well, he was here before you were. What do you mean?
I know, right?
All right.
Well, come here, showing up. I can't do words today. It's been a weird week.
Yeah, I've been doing LLC tax paperwork. I don't recommend it.
Been midterms. Yeah, I've had midterms. Spring break's coming up. My brain's hitting about the consistency of pudding.
You know, if it was the same process for filing your personal taxes, it would be different, right?
Fair.
But because there is no just... go on to TurboTax and fill out your 1065 form and just submit it digitally. No, I have to fill everything out in form fillable PDF and then print it all off and then mail it in.
In triplicate?
No, not in triplicate.
Okay.
It's either that or pay someone $300 to do it for me.
Fair.
And whenever we don't make $300 in a year, I can't afford to do that. So... But anyway, that's enough about a creator. Yeah.
Yes.
That's enough about all of that. So let's get a little bit on topic here. So Josh, if you would please give us a brief reintroduction and tell us a little bit about this project that you got.
Yeah. So I'm Josh Rosing. I've been playing tabletop RPGs for pretty much over half of my life, and I've been designing them for over a third of it. I run a company called Lone Colossus Games, which consists of just me. I do all of the project management and most of the writing and game design, and then the rest of it gets filled in by wonderfully skilled freelancers that I get to hire because of crowdfunding campaigns like the one that is coming up on Tuesday. So Tome of Intangible Treasures is a compendium of more than 450 new ways to provide story-based character rewards and mechanical growth options. You can think of it a little bit like a magic item compendium, except that none of the rewards are physical things. They're all, you know, boons or blessings, pacts, various intangible rewards that you could get for your adventures.
This means the kobolds cannot steal them.
This is true.
In theory.
In theory.
In theory.
I won't say a kobold god can't do it.
Yeah, fair.
Well, Colonel Mock has to get out of the labyrinth first. So.
First, yes.
So, Josh, what inspired you to make a book of intangible rewards? And are there any individual rewards that you've included that you really want to highlight, some of your personal favorites?
Sure. So I guess in terms of inspiration, there wasn't necessarily one thing that got me thinking about it, but I think where the idea really originated was actually I was working on a variety of new mechanics for character creation for a campaign that I was running. So I developed like some alternate race and background stuff, kind of similar to what they ended up doing with Tasha's, with like letting you readjust all of your stats and like pick things to separate from everything, but it was more tied to like regions and stuff. That's not related to this book, but I did introduce histories in that campaign because we were starting at like fifth level, and I was like, okay, well, backgrounds end at level one usually. Mm-hmm. So what did you do between level one and level five? And then I'm going to give you a little bit of like story based rewards for that. So for that, I just had my players, you know, write up a little thing, and I was like, okay, well, you spent time as a scholar doing this stuff, I'll give you a little bit of bonus on like history or arcana, your choice. So that's where histories kind of came from in this book. And then at the same time, I was also getting an itch to try and create something more like prestige classes from 3.5 in 5th edition. I knew that I didn't want those to be actual class levels, but I still like multi-classing a lot. And I like finding those weird flavor combinations, and they don't always work very well.
Right.
So if you want to play like a bard cleric or something where like they're not on the same casting stat, that can be really tricky. So,
you just reminded me of so much of my youth, like the bard cleric. I think that's specifically like in the Protestant church, like the worship director. And that is a very particular type of person. So, well done.
Well, I have a character. I haven't actually gotten to play her, but I have a character that I've created that is a multi-class lore bard, knowledge domain cleric, and divination wizard.
Ooh.
She's an archaeologist. And she literally communes with the spirits of the dead to help her interpret the things that she uncovers in the archaeological digs.
That's very pretty cool. Awesome. And yeah. I could see, like, looking at the extra histories and the section of, like, your education, your special trainings that you have, I could see you dialing in something like that just beautifully. Because, I mean, you had so many of these, like, extra training things that I got excited when I saw those. Because it very much did have that 3.5 flavor to it.
Yeah, for sure. In terms of, like, favorites on the list, my favorite thing is always the thing that I just made. But my favorite advanced training might be one of the first ones that I made, which is the Ultimate Magus, which is straight up just inspired by the 3.5 Ultimate Magus, which is that like sorcerer wizard blend, because that was one of my favorite characters that I ever played was an Ultimate Magus. Getting to like have all of the like knowledge of a wizard, but then still have like some innate magical talent. So it was this like studying combined with that innate strength. So I wanted to try and capture that in what it would look like in 5e. And that was like one of the first ones that I made. But yeah, definitely have made a lot more since then.
Right.
No, I think that would be a fun character class too. Because I mean, just taking a wizard and multiclassing with sorcerer, just to use some of that meta magic, or if you go wild mage, meh, but if you got some of the like the draconic bloodline abilities with your wizard would be kind of scary after a while. So no, I like that concept. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Or, you know, multiclassing evocation wizard with like a storm sorcerer.
Ooh, yeah. Let's do it. And I really like that you started talking about, you know, these other classes you want to incorporate in. Because like, as I was reading through, especially the first, you started talking about boons. And boons are these like non-tangible bonuses or gifts that the characters get. And boons really have that warlock feel like you'd get from a patron. And you do bring in some of those, like I saw you talked about the fey or evil sources or, you know, the great old ones. And that feels very warlock. And to have those warlock boons and warlock packs, well, you've got your three main ones. I mean, there's a handful of other ones thrown in there. I like that you kind of delved into this. And from the sounds of it, these are available for other classes as well?
Yeah, so the only thing that's class locked in the book is the advanced trainings. Those are very much focused on specific archetypes. Like, basically, you need 5 levels in the correct classes to qualify for those. Those are the only things with class requirements so far. Boons, blessings, well, boons and blessings mechanically are the same thing. They just flavor-wise felt different, and I wanted to have those kind of both as flavor options, but they are going to be in the same section. They're mechanically the same thing. I should say boons and blessings are kind of the like most magic item equivalent. So some of the powers might feel like, oh yeah, if you like threw this on a ring, it could be a cool magic item. But with a boon or a blessing, it's on you, right? You can't trade it. People can't steal it. It's not worth any money because it's on you and it can't be removed except by maybe the being that gave it to you or some other being, if you really wanted to get rid of it, could get rid of it for you. But yeah, they're available to all characters. Boons and blessings and charms are all, I see them as mostly a like, could be a reward for doing something for, let's say you rescue like a nature spirit from some terrible thing that was happening to its environment. It might grant you a boon as a reward. It might bless you, right? Or let's say you're going to go do something for like a church, right? And they offer you a blessing of their deity as like part of your quest, and it's going to be a temporary reward. You could represent that blessing as a charm that they give you. So you have, say, like 2 weeks to use up this charm. It's going to benefit you like one time, or it could be like a small boon that only lasts 2 weeks and then it wears off. Or you can enter into a pact with a being. So often we think about pacts as being like a warlock thing or being entered with, you know, a devil or like a fey, perhaps you could have a pact with. But I have pacts for all of the different entity types. So you could enter into a pact with a celestial being. Maybe you promise that you're going to do, you know, some great deed for it, or that you're going to, you could have a price to the pact that is you offer up part of yourself essentially in service to the being. And so you sacrifice something in a moment to gain tremendous power for a short period of time. And so some pacts are going to be like a permanent effect. Some of them could be, like I said, you activate the pact for a short time by doing something, sacrificing something. And maybe that cost is a thing that you can keep repeating every time you want to activate it. Or maybe it's like a one-time thing that could be up to the DM, how they want to represent that pact. If it's a like, I promise you, I will give you power once, right? When you want this power, call on it and you will sacrifice something in that moment and you will get it.
I like that. This room actually reminds me again of a 3.5 character I have. I used to have. He was an evil half-orc cleric that hated halflings. And actually, when I played World of Warcraft at the time, I reached a meme into that. But basically, I promise I will slaughter 10 halflings for this power. And then I'd go through and my character would go on a rampage. And if I killed 10 halflings, I could cast like an extra spell or whatever for that. So that reminds me of that. And that was kind of a homebrew thing with me and my DM at the time. But again, your stuff has this wonderful 3.5 feel that kind of reminds me of my early playing days. That it makes me very happy.
Was that the character that anointed the crowd with holy oil?
Yes. And then I torched the entire caravan.
That was yeah. Evil characters, people.
That was a great evil character. It was so much fun.
Talk about it with your party before you do it.
Yes.
Fair.
This is our standard episode warning.
Yes.
All right. So one of the things that we wanted to ask about is that there are some boons already in the books. They are specifically rewards for characters that go beyond the standard level 20. So they're big things like, you know, gaining 60 maximum hit points or something like that. So I realize that there's only so many words that you can use for these sort of options. But how do you feel your boons in your book compare, contrast with those end game rewards?
Sure. I think in terms of like flavor and how you get them, they're probably relatively similar, right? Like you're getting it from a powerful being. Depending on the power level of the boon or blessing, you know, you could be getting it from someone who serves that being, right? So like a priest could give you a blessing, but it's not going to be, you know, equivalent of like a very rare magic item, right? It might be uncommon. Maybe like, you know, a high priest could give you something that's rare to maybe very rare. Legendary is gonna be from a god, right? Or some archangel or something like that. The pacts are even actually, so the boons and blessings and charms, they all use the same rarity system as magic items to help you get a sense for like how powerful they're supposed to be relative to a magic item. So if you wanted to replace magic items in your campaign, have a really low like magic item quantity in your world, but still hand out magic item equivalents, boons, blessings, and charms are great for that. And you would be able to use them just like you would magic items. You just have to keep in mind that like there's no attunement with them because you literally cannot trade them. The purpose of attunement is usually, you know, we want to limit the number of these types that you can have. And also, I don't want you giving this item to your friend in the middle of combat and having you just like switch back and forth who has fire resistance, right? Something like that, right? That's usually the reason why you have attunement on things. So the fact that you can't get rid of them means that it's not as big of a deal that they don't have it. But yeah, in terms of balance compared to the boons in the Dungeon Master's Guide, they're not intended for epic level characters necessarily. Some of them are legendary level or very rare. Those could be good examples of that. But for the most part, they're intended to be like boons that you could give to a lower level character. And you wouldn't be like, oh yeah, I'm giving you 60 more hit points at level 5. That's kind of ridiculous.
You're now immortal. I bless you. No, that's great. Now, again, you've talked a lot about, and you've mentioned wanting that third edition, 3.5 edition. With that in mind, is this designed solely for 5th edition, or is it more system agnostic and maybe lean possibly towards like Pathfinder as well, or is it specifically D&D?
Yeah, it's definitely mechanically everything is designed with 5e in mind. I think there are a number of things that would convert pretty easily into Pathfinder and other editions of D&D. Usually it's just a numbers change, at least for other editions of D&D. For Pathfinder, I know that like when you convert things, sometimes it's nice to just change the way mechanics work, because especially in second edition Pathfinder, you can do fun things like how many actions does it take to activate, right? Or like certain things work differently there, so you can actually apply different types of effects and things. But the only thing that I would think wouldn't necessarily translate as easily are the advanced trainings, because those are class specific. They rely on class mechanics in 5e. But 3.5 already has its prestige classes, and you know, Pathfinder has its dedications and whatnot. So I think if I were to translate them to Pathfinder, I would do them as a dedication.
Okay.
I don't have enough experience with Pathfinder to, I mean, the words you're saying make sense because I have played enough games to where I can extrapolate what would make sense, but how the specifics would work, it just goes way over my head because I haven't opened up a Pathfinder book in forever.
Yeah, I would love to start converting things to Pathfinder, but it's a whole separate project to do that. Maybe eventually I'll be able to offer 5e and Pathfinder side by side in a campaign, but This one's not that one.
Right. Okay. So we had the privilege of looking at the backer preview version of mm-hmm. this book, which is obviously not the complete thing. It's a very cherry-picked sampling of it.
Yeah.
So talking about the advanced trainings that you had in there, the ones that were in the preview were for a very select few classes. Do all of the classes get a little bit of love in this?
Yes.
Or is it going to be more skewed towards casters, more skewed towards half casters?
Yeah, the current plan is to have around 40 advanced trainings in the book. Obviously, there's 12 classes that I can work with, which means there are 144 different possible combinations. I won't be covering all of those clearly, but I'm going to do my best to keep an even representation of different classes. I might have some favorites that will get a lot more than others. My hope is to use these to encourage builds that aren't normally super viable, but I am also going to have one that is for if you don't multi-class, because that's certainly a very common thing to play with. And so those are kind of, what would the druidiest druid be? What's the rangeriest ranger, right? What's the monkiest monk?
I love it. So with your boons and blessings, we've seen just a small sampling, or you've got a lot to offer. We saw just a small smidge of it. A lot of these look nice. Are they all beneficial, or are some of them double-edged swords?
Yeah, the boons and blessings are generally going to be all beneficial. The pacts are intended to either have costs associated with it that would warrant like doing a quest to earn. So like one of the fey pacts that I have in mind, and pacts can be across multiple types of entities, so you might see declared like what kinds I would suggest you use them for, but you know, you could potentially have like a pact of corruption or something that is given to you by an unholy being, but it could also be from like an aberration or something, right? Different types of creatures might have an overlap in like what their domains are. Sorry, what was your original question with that?
The boons, do any of them have like double-edged swords where they have a bit of a cost
right.
to them?
Yeah, so the pacts are kind of intended as the double-edged sword version, right? Where okay. you might have a cost, or there's always a cost associated with it. Usually when you accept the pact, when you enter into the pact, there's a cost that you pay, and sometimes also when you activate whatever the effect is, there is a cost that you pay for it.
Nice.
So they tend to be a little bit more powerful, but also there's a risk with them.
I do personally enjoy that kind of ability because, again, you've got this big shiny red button and you want to push the red button, but it's going to cost you. And it's yes. like, is it worth it? I can only do it once, maybe. Do I do it now?
Yeah.
Those are always fun.
It gives some Dresden Files vibes, especially yes. in some of the later books.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like I'm always chasing the, like, so I'm always a DM, and I always want my players yeah. to take these like bargains of power of like, you know, accept the demon in the coin and like, you know, yes. draw power from it. Have your free hot shower.
Yeah.
See what that yeah. tempts you to do later.
Now, see, Ian brought up Dresden Files, so I get to bring it up now too. But you were talking about like the boons or the gifts that you can activate maybe once for a thing. And I am reminded of Dresden, and another wizard got a token from the Fae that, hey, at any one point, if you need us, you can call on us and we will bail you out this one time. And I mean, even for as a DM to give that to a party member, hey, you know, one time, here is your, we bit off more than we can chew, help me fix it problem. And I mean, that is a great tool just to toss to your players.
And I just love the way he ended up using it in the end. I'm not going to go into details because that is major spoilers for the book that it's in. But right. I love the way that yes. he used it.
So speaking of like, you know, do I use this now? You know, I find, and I think a lot of people find this, when you hand out consumables in a campaign, you just hoard them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Other than maybe health potions, but people will just sit on things and it's like, oh, it's the final boss. We have like 50 random consumables that we never used. And now is not even really the time for it either. So the charms, that's where that like 2 weeks.
Yeah, that was brilliant. Oh my God, that was so brilliant.
If you're going to give out a consumable, put a time limit on it. And this is a great way to have a time limit.
Yeah, use it or lose it.
So like, yeah, you could probably do it with some chemical stuff where it's like, yeah, it's going to wear out. If you don't use it in 2 weeks, you have to remake it or something like that, right? But
ooh, yeah, a potion that heals you, but if it expires, it like takes life instead. It'd be like soured milk.
Oh. Oh.
Yeah, that'd be a great effect. So like it'll heal you for so much, and then if not, then it has like 1d4 poison damage.
It's the Zelda, whatever the like pixelated food is that you can make in Breath of the Wild.
Yes.
It does a random effect. It's like either it hurts you a little bit, or maybe it gives you like half a heart.
Yeah, I love it. Well done.
1d4 minus 3 hit points.
Yes.
Yeah. So How early in the game are you picturing each of these different rewards being viable? I know that you mentioned that some of them have rarity levels, which would help a DM pick at a glance which ones would be appropriate for which character levels. But, you know, just in general, when would you think that DMs would be able to start giving out some of these rewards to their party?
Yeah, I mean, whenever you want, for the most part. You can hand out a legendary item at level one if you want to. So you can hand out a legendary boon at level one if you want to.
Yeah.
For like boons and blessings and charms, I would just follow the same general guidelines for handing out magic items. For histories and advanced trainings, those have more like level suggestions for them. Advanced trainings are like actually a requirement that you must be at least level 5 for any advanced training. That's mostly because of the class features that they require. So if you are multi-classing, you're going to have 3 levels in one class and 2 levels in another. A lot of classes get their core features in the first 2 or 3 levels. So you need to have at least that many levels. And so then to make that kind of balanced across all of them, I expect you to be level 5 or higher. And then for histories, I kind of leave it up to the DM how often they want to do it. But I would recommend probably like you get one at like level 5 or 6, another one around level 11, maybe another one around like 16 or 17, right? So like if you're doing a 1-20 campaign, right, every quarter of your full like arc.
Around those transitions from like tier 1 to tier 2, tier 2 to tier 3. Yep. Yeah. Okay. Yep.
And then titles come whenever they're appropriate, right? So like if you do something that is worthy of being known, you know, people know that you did this thing and you're a little bit famous for it, or, you know, locally famous for it, right? You should probably have some sort of title to represent that.
I love the title idea too. That brings all kinds of warm, fun memories. And that's a quick way to give a fun nickname to your table party people, you know, just like, hey, you did this. This is your new title. One of the games I'm playing, one of our younger players went and tried to wake up. My party previously got attacked by, they stepped into an ant swarm. So they got attacked by a swarm of ants. And the cleric in that battle took surprisingly way more damage than we were expecting. So the next night they were on watch and she was trying to alert everyone. So she just starts screaming ants, thinking that it would get the cleric to work because the cleric had this big fight. And so now we call the character Ant Screamer. So, I mean, it's just like one of those titles. So, but yeah, I love titles, and you could, here's your title and your nickname. Congratulations.
And I like the fact that some of these things, especially like the advanced trainings, do have a level requirement.
Yeah,
because these are things that are going to be acquired through experience. And so you're not going to have that experience as a level 1 or level 2 character. You have to have at least a little bit of grit acquired from multiple encounters in order to start building up that repertoire of skills.
What do you mean? I got my shiny new diploma. I'm going to be a CEO.
I mean, just start a company, then you're a CEO.
Fair, fair.
I mean, if you want to do the taxes for it, that's fine. I was
like, Ian's not bitter, not at all.
Nah.
No, but yeah, I love all these things you've come up with. And even the mid-level stuff really kind of makes me want to make mid-level characters. And I think mid-level characters kind of get lost a lot. You've got a lot of early, you know, 1 to 5, because that's where most people want to start. You get a couple high-end, like 15 to 20, but that mid-level kind of disappears a lot of times. And you give enough prompts for character building and world building with that, that you can kind of start plugging things in. And just with the prompts in your book, even if you're making NPCs, you could make some awesome NPCs with these characters and these prompts and just kind of take that, here's a framework and go.
Yeah, you're talking about the suggested adventures on the histories?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So are there any of these, I know you mentioned a couple earlier on, but are there any of these rewards that are not in the preview that you really want to let people know about as sort of a way to entice them into backing the project?
God, there's so many that I like that aren't in there. I guess I should say the one thing that's not in the preview are the master trainers. So every advanced training in the book is going to have an NPC that goes along with it that you can use to, you know, act as the NPC that's training your party member. They will all come with a little bit of lore with them, descriptions, and then some hooks that will either, you know, help you introduce them to the party, maybe a quest that they have to do before they will train the character, or some hooks that will help you maybe plan a quest that is the training. I would love for the advanced trainings to all be like a specific character quest, right? So like, you know, like in certain games, you have to do like this character's quest and they unlock a special power. I would love for advanced trainings to be that for, you know, D&D characters.
No, I like that. And I do like, I can think of several games that are like that I really enjoyed those quests because it makes you vested in the character. It's not just like, hey, I get stuff. It's no, I had to do something to get stuff.
Yeah.
And it harkens back to especially the older expansions of World of Warcraft where you had to find the different profession trainers. You know, there would be the one that you could only train the stuff with them once you hit max level and that skill to unlock your last few recipes and stuff like that. And it reminds me, I've never actually run this game, but I had the concept for a game where sort of trying to get back to a little more of the gold for XP idea that you had in the early editions, where in order to gain a level, you had to find a trainer who knew something that you didn't and you pay them to train you, and each level costs more because you have to find the trainer and then you have to pay the trainer something that is worth their while.
Yeah, that has a heavy Morrowind feel and Elder Scrolls. But yeah, I do like that too.
Yeah.
So last question I have. So I've noticed that this particular project is not going to be on Kickstarter. It's on BackerKit. And I've seen a lot of people starting to move towards BackerKit for their crowdfunding projects. And I was just wanting to know from your perspective as someone who has run multiple crowdfunding campaigns, why the switch and what benefits you're going to be getting by going to BackerKit as opposed to Kickstarter.
Sure. Yeah, there's a couple of reasons. The kind of initial primary one that got me to really consider them. So they reached out to me asking if I wanted to launch on their platform. And at first I was like, I'll stick with Kickstarter because I know it. I know there's probably more people on it. But I kept seeing more and more generative AI content on Kickstarter in the last year. And it's really, I feel like, kind of poisoned the well in Kickstarter. I know that there are obviously a lot of great projects that are still, like, you know, totally human made over there. But, you know, I'm really opposed to the use of generative AI for commercial projects, especially because they're not currently ethically created.
Right.
And I would prefer not to support a platform that allows their use. You know, if you're just scrolling through Kickstarter, chances are within, you know, every 5 to 10 projects, you're going to find at least one that's making a lot of money and is using generative AI. BackerKit has a anti-generative AI stance. They do not allow it on their platform. But that definitely wasn't the only reason either. I've used BackerKit for my pledge manager and for marketing on my previous projects. I generally like the people there. They have a Discord and people are active there. Everyone's really friendly and their team is super helpful. Not that I've ever necessarily reached out to Kickstarter too much for help, but like, BackerKit's very involved in getting creators on board. And on top of that, their platform has some really cool tools for interacting with backers. So they have polls, they have discussions. You know, it's not just the comment section on Kickstarter. You have like a whole suite of tools that you can use to interact with people. And like even in pre-launch, I've been able to make updates, you know, share extra content with people, ask people what they want to see. And so like, I feel like it's been a more fun platform to use as a creator on top of that. So
awesome.
Yeah, I've noticed that, you know, because I started following the project and I've been seeing the polls coming out, and it's really cool to be able to have that interaction with potential backers and not have to wait until the project is live and running and you're seeing, you know, whether or not people are going to start backing it before you. It helps you gauge interaction a little bit more, I guess, is where I'm getting at.
Yeah. They have a fun thing that they just made the default, but did exist before, that they call overtime mode. So when you get to the end of the campaign won't end until there's no back for 10 minutes. So like some campaigns will keep going for like 7 hours because people are still arriving cool. I'm not the last person. Cool. I want to keep, you know, keep this going. So they have like a fun, they call it a backer train. So you can see like how many backers have been consecutive. So you can like keep it going. And obviously as a creator, that's just like fun to see like how many people have gone, you know, in a row. And I feel like as a backer, it's like, oh, timer's almost out. I better make sure I get my pledge in, because you can always change it later. Right. But like kind of a fun little mechanic.
No, that's a great idea. And it sounds like a good venue to kind of put up your programs and back things up. And this definitely sounds like a good option. And I like that you're taking the stand against AI, because, the whole scrubbing thing kind of really sucks.
Yeah. And part of the reason why I'm asking is because we're starting to finalize a couple of projects that we're going to be wanting to start putting together for crowdfunding, primarily for artwork, because art is expensive whenever you have to actually pay people to do it.
Yeah.
Imagine that. And that's something that we've been looking into, and I like getting feedback from people who are actually using the platform instead of just going through and reading the FAQ page on the website, because, you know, they're going to be cherry picking what details they want to let you know about. So it's always great to interact with the people who are actually using it to create projects and, you know, getting the feedback on, are they really good to work with? Are they convenient? Are they productive? Are they easy to work with? Those sorts of things. So.
Yeah. And I think, you know, right now, because they're still growing, when you create a project on BackerKit, they assign someone to you to help you through it. I'm sure once they get big enough, they won't be able to do that. Or at least whenever companies get to a certain point in size, like, they have to sacrifice some sort of quality, right? When you create a project on Kickstarter, you have no idea what you're doing. No one's helping you at all. Like, you have to go look up stuff, read it for yourself. Still recommend doing all of that. It's really good to do that. You'll learn a lot. But the fact that they're helping you and there is someone to kind of guide, like, hey, maybe you're not quite ready to launch. In fact, they have a thing in your dashboard when you're a new creator. Well, when you, if you're a creator, but especially if you're a new creator, this is helpful. You know, they say, based on your average pledge that you expect and based on how many emails you have, here's how much funding we think you can get. So on Kickstarter, what happens a lot, and the reason why so many Kickstarters fail, is that people go to launch and they haven't done any prep work for, you know, getting people following the page and stuff. And they go to launch and there's just crickets, right? No one backs. No one knows it exists. You could have the coolest project ever, and if no one knows it exists, then you're not going to get any following. On BackerKit, they kind of give you that little heads up of like, hey, make sure you have enough people, make sure that you're ready. And that's probably why, like, earlier this year, they said, hey, last year we had 90% of projects on BackerKit were successful, which is insanely high compared to Kickstarter. Yeah. And obviously, part of it is they have experienced crowdfunding people coming in. Those are the first people using their platform, but also they do guide you through it and make sure that you're ready to launch before you actually launch. So
yeah, I've had a few projects that I have backed through BackerKit. I know that MCDM has started using BackerKit. They're one of the big names that really, I think, brought a lot of crowdfunding backers onto the platform.
Yeah.
But another one recently, Michael Ross with Action 12 Cinema, he did his project through BackerKit. And speaking of which, I actually just got that in the mail.
Woohoo.
If I can find it, I've gone and put it down somewhere. And here I was all excited about it because my name is in that book, because I am the editor on that book, and I was going to show it off and everything. And now I can't seem to figure out where I put it. Aw, biscuit.
So as awesome as BackerKit is, and it does sound like it's a great venue if you want to post something up, your project sounds even better. And so if we're up and we're ready to back this, do we have an estimated time frame of when it'll be out and ready?
Yeah. Are you asking about the campaign launching, or are you asking about when the book will be released?
Both.
Okay. So the campaign is launching on March 5th at 9 a.m. Pacific time. And that should be exactly true, because the other cool thing that they have is that with their launch party page, it'll go live automatically with Kickstarter. You have to be there and press the button. If you're not able to do that because you woke up late or something like that, then it just takes away so much stress. So I'm glad that that is there. But anyway, it'll be going live at 9 a.m. Pacific time on March 5th. That's this Tuesday. And then the book, I'm giving myself plenty of time to get it done. So I'm saying digital copies probably December, and then physical copies maybe around this time next year.
I'm just saying, if you want to do some early Christmas shopping, wink, wink.
Yeah.
All right. I think that's just about everything that I had. James, do you have any more questions?
No. Like I said, I'm stoked and ready for Christmas.
Yeah. All right. We'll get into the where to find it here at the end of the episode. But right now we are going back into that fan favorite portion, the monster mashup, where we roll some dice and make a monster on the fly. So, Josh, do you have your dice ready?
I do. They even have skulls in them.
Ooh,
excellent. Dice. We like skull dice.
Me too.
All right. So when you are ready, can you give me a D4 for locomotion?
Chugga, 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 chugga.
A one. It flies. We haven't had a flyer in a long time.
We haven't.
This will be great.
We've had a lot of runners, but we have. Okay, we've got something that flies. Okay.
All right. Next is a D6 for what does it eat?
Potatoes.
Maybe.
It eats a five.
Five. Meat / carrion.
So some sort of bird of prey, or maybe like a buzzard or a carrion eater. Yeah.
Potentially.
Maybe like a giant bat.
I mean, this next roll is going to help us narrow that down a lot. Next is going to be another D6 for size.
It's a 4.
4. It is large.
Okay. So again, giant bat, condor. I think rocks are huge, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. It's a baby rock.
Yeah, it's a baby rock. And maybe a small dragon.
It's a rock, pebble.
Some wyverns, some griffins. Yeah. A pebble. Nice.
It took you a minute.
PBL.
I had like the 8-second, you know, timer to like tick, 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 tick.
Yeah. Yeah, we're on the 6-second live TV delay.
Yeah, so you can bleep me out in case my Tourette's goes crazy.
Except that we're not, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, we are between what we're seeing right now and what they're seeing on Twitch, but
fair.
We can't actually do anything in that time.
No, there is no censoring my Tourette's.
Okay, getting back on track. Can we get a D8 roll for social organization?
It's a 5.
5. The pack. 3 to 10 individuals.
So I'm seeing like small family unit, perhaps. So again, this could be a pebble, a young bird of prey, or again, something like a dragon or a wyvern, or I'm trying to think. I mean, honestly, it doesn't even have to be a bestial creature. It could be like some sort of spectral thing, a ghost or like a flying ooze.
Yeah, it could be like a flump. It could be
a flump and a ooze.
Giant mutant flumps that float across as carrion eaters. Or, you know, my brain is going to like drakes a little bit.
Okay, wait. You talked about carrion eaters, so what if they're a flump and so they are, you know, generally good and they're carrion eaters, so they're on the battlefield and maybe they guide the spirits to their next, you know, whatever their paradise is type thing.
Potentially.
Yeah, I don't know.
We'll be able to find out off of the next couple of rolls, maybe. So
perhaps. I'm trying to be good and avoid nightmare fuel, though I'll probably take a hard left straight into nightmare fuel and roll or two.
Well, here in a couple rolls, we can make a hard left. But the next one is a D10 roll for native environment.
8.
8. Mountains.
Okay, nope, this still holds up well. Again, definitely feeling something draconic.
Yeah, I'm reptilian. Maybe not necessarily draconic, but definitely reptilian.
Or something like a manta ray, but that flies.
Okay.
It'd be kind of cool.
We could do something like that. So next is a D12 roll for method of defense.
11.
11. It has spines.
Ooh, drop bears. It sits there and it flies over and it curls up and it just hits you with this giant spiky ball.
It's a telekinetic carnivorous durian plant.
Yes. Or it could just have like a spiked tail that it uses to swipe things with.
Yeah. Kind of like the cadaver collector, except that's how it picks up the carrion.
Yeah. It'd be like those old litter sticks that you used to stab and have to pick up like paper cups with. Okay.
Yeah, a little bit. Okay. Now this is where we can make the hard left turn, potentially. Another D12 roll for creature type.
8.
8. It is a fiend.
Ooh.
Yep. There we go. I still like it. Okay. Fiendish. Ooh.
I mean, it makes the spikes make more sense.
It really does. And I do see this as something that would haunt more like a battlefield now, as well as, again, maybe have some sort of spectral astral aspect to it, as well as just maybe eats the body so the spirits can't return to the body. So like if they're in that like middle phase and they're trying to get back, it consumes the body as part of its food. And now the spirits are trapped without form.
So
would it like trap the souls when it eats the body, basically?
Maybe that, or it's like
a fiend, maybe it wants the souls, and then its way to get those is by eating the body.
Or maybe with, you know, you have the blood war, so maybe it eats devils so the devils can't reincorporate once they're dead.
Right. And I can see this as being, this is a certain type of fiend that would travel with one or the other, either demons or devils, whenever they travel outside of their home plane.
Yeah.
Because if I remember correctly, and this may be wrong, but if a devil dies in Baytor, they're done. But if they die outside of Baytor, then the spirit returns to Baytor and they're reincarnated.
Yeah.
And so this would be a way to dispatch fiends that are too badly injured to return so that their spirits will return and they will be reincarnated.
Okay, yeah, so this is like pushing him for the insta-respawn instead of letting him take population. Okay, it's brutal, but I like it.
Well, I mean, it's the Blood War.
Yeah, it is the Blood War. Fair.
You know, it makes sense.
It does.
That brutal efficiency makes sense.
So it's kind of like when you have fighting ants and one of them's wounded, they'll dispatch their ant and then sometimes they cannibalize or they just leave it there because, again, it's not worth spending the resources keeping it up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, that went a little dark, but I'm with you.
Okay. Next up is a D20 roll for quirks.
It sings happy birthday every day.
Eight.
Eight. Okay. It can break off its limbs for escape and they grow back, usually.
This goes well with kind of both the reptilian feel as well as that spine feel. That would make sense as a point of defense because those spines could break off. It'd be like a Roman pilum, you know?
Yeah.
It'd weigh a person down. It could be how it dispatches things as well. Possibly it could fire like, you know, they used to think a porcupine could shoot its quills. Perhaps it can launch some of those spines a short distance.
Oh, I like that, the porcupine reference. I like the thought that, you know, as a way to escape, it'll slap something with this appendage covered in spines and a bunch of the spines will break off.
Yeah.
And that will impede the attacker sufficiently for them to get away.
Snazzy. Terrifying, but snazzy.
I mean, because I think we're fairly solidly in the camp that this is sort of a carrion eater and an eater of the dying.
Yeah.
So this is a creature that is going to be going after things that are not necessarily hardy enough to put up a whole lot of a fight to fight back.
Yeah.
And so anything that puts up a huge fight is going to be considered a threat and it's going to try and get away from it.
Or if something tries to rescue the thing that it's trying to dispatch and or eat.
True. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So now we make it weird.
It's not weird already.
No.
Nope. So if we could please get a D100 roll.
88. Lots of eights today.
Ooh. Yeah.
An 88.
You're rolling fairly high. I like it. Those are good dice.
Okay. This is one that we've not had before, which I'm happy about because some of these, despite it being a D100 table, we've gotten like four times.
Yeah.
88 can create enough electricity to power a light bulb for a year and a day.
Again, with those spines, that makes a lot of sense. You could have something like static electricity arcs through the spines as well.
Yeah.
And again, if you hit those spines, maybe those spines break off and enough of a jolt that it also temporarily paralyzes for like a round or two.
So I'm really liking your previous suggestion of like a manta ray type thing.
Okay.
And I'm thinking like, you know, because it would be able to fly through the air, that makes sense. You know, it could have a whole bunch of spines, like just down actual spine, and then also like a clump on the tail, right? And then, yeah, maybe all of them are like electrified because that feels like an eel type thing. So I'm going back to like sea creatures, manta rays, and then they would like come in like a pack. It's like bringing hounds with you, except you're bringing the like, you know, manta ray fiends that eat the dying and dying fiends back to respawn.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, it's great. And, you know, I like the mental image of it, too, because then all you see is this thing. It descends onto this body and then it wraps itself around it.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's you don't see any of the carnage, but you hear all of the carnage. And that's a special kind of squick.
It is a special kind of squick. I was trying to be good this episode, but you know what? Nightmare fuel it is.
All right. So, James, do you want to do the second one or do you want me to do the second one?
I'll let you go ahead and roll it.
All right. So second one is going to be a 53. 53 is okay. Can cast one random spell of first to third level once per day.
It's got to be Fireball.
Not Lightning Bolt.
Lightning Bolt would also be great. Yes.
Yeah, Lightning Bolt is also a third level spell. Yeah.
Oh.
If only it went higher, because Chain Lightning would be perfect. But
Chain Lightning would be perfect.
But I mean, even Shocking Grasp. Yeah, because it's first to third.
That's actually good, too, because it could paralyze again if a victim is still semi-mobile. It would hit it, paralyze it, dispatch it.
Or like Hold Person.
Oh, Hold Person. Good one.
Although I guess if they're dealing with fiends, that wouldn't work anyway. So
yeah.
All right.
No, I'm liking this thing.
Yeah, this is cool. This is a cool one. I think we've gotten a much more solid mental image of what this thing is and what it does than we normally do.
Yeah.
A lot of the ones that we've been doing lately have been fairly amorphous up until the very end. And I like the way that we constructed this one. It came together really nicely.
Yeah.
All right. So to recap what we've got, It flies. It eats meat slash carrion. It is large in size. It is a pack creature in groups of 3 to 10. Its native environment is mountains. It has spines as a method of defense. It is a fiend creature type. It has autonomy, which means it can break off parts of its body and they will grow back. It is capable of making electricity enough to power a light bulb for a year and a day. And it can cast one random spell of first to third level once per day. So now the hard question is, what do we call it?
Steve Irwin. No.
Boo.
Boo. You were talking spines. I almost wanted to call it a snuggle bunny, but I don't think that works either.
You are a bad person and you should feel bad.
Okay, so it's fiendish. It's got this ray thing. So, you know, you've got like the Manta Ray or the Diablo Ray, the Manta Diablo. I think if we start pushing in that direction.
So the first question that I have is this devilish, demonic, or Yugoloth in origin?
I could see this being Yugoloth and being used by either side.
Yeah.
Yeah. It does have a very mercenary feel to it, doesn't it?
It does. And I could see like somehow getting like two or three large groups of these and somehow, and again, while they do feed on carrion, they're fairly weak. I could see these being trained up as some form of early shock troop or like behind the line.
Like mounts maybe?
Mounts,
yeah, because they're big enough.
Or like an assault creature to like pick off. Because again, you're flying up and if this thing just drops on you and it can jolt something hard enough that if it's not already wounded, it could make it wounded enough to dispatch it. Because again, you got the spines, you've got the jolt, you've got that first to third level spell. So this could be like an infiltration or an assassination type unit as well.
And I like having it be a Yugoloth based creature because then that means that both sides in the Blood War can have them.
Yes. These seems to be terrifying to see in the sky. I'm just, I like, yeah.
Just look up. Oh, hey, it's those flying. Oh, crap.
Like you'd have that.
It's a 12-foot wingspan ray just covered in spines flying through the air. Yeah, that's terrifying.
And it's got that electricity, so it'd have a nimbus. It would look like
just like electric arcs coming off the tail. Yeah.
Yeah, and it'll crackle a little bit. Yeah.
Mm. Like they'd have a feel of a thunderstorm coming
in. Terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have, you know, that ozone smell coming off of them.
Ooh, they could cast Call Lightning. That's a first.
They could cast Call Lightning.
If you had like 10 of them in a row, just like going down over ranks. Oh, I want to play with these so bad.
Yeah, because Call Lightning is what, a second level spell?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Second or third.
Okay, so getting back to the naming.
Infernal Nimbus. Because again, they are infernal and they have that lightning feel to them.
I kind of want to have Ray or Skate kind of be part of the name.
Gotcha.
I kind of like a Nimbus Skate.
Okay. Or the Skate of the Damned or something like that. Because again, you see these things and it's generally taking those that are broken but trying to hold on and it's just dispatching them normally. Yeah. Or it's picking people off the field. So it is, again, these are definitely a bad omen.
Or maybe something.
Like you see these things, it's not a good day.
Maybe something like a Tempest Ray.
Ooh, I like that. Tempest Ray. That feels good. Yeah. That comes off the tongue well.
I mean, the first thing that came to mind was a Nether Ray, but I didn't want to use that because of the World of Warcraft reference.
Fair. No, but Tempest Ray, that does come off the tongue
and
really nice.
And that plays into the whole electricity thing. You know, a Tempest is usually this very chaotic storm that leaves a lot of destruction in its wake. And so it has a lot of that symbolism built into it.
Yeah.
So I kind of like that. Okay.
Nice.
All right. Well, that was fun. So, Josh, I forgot to remind you of this. So if you don't have anybody lined up, that's okay. Usually whenever we have our guests on, we ask them to give a shout out to someone else in the TTRPG community. It can be a content creator. It can be a map maker, a musician, artist, just anybody who is involved in the TTRPG sphere. Do you have anybody who you would like to give a shout out to today?
Yeah, Chris at Hunts on Games, he's got a Kickstarter for Relict RPG, which is active right now. It's a pretty cool system. One of my more anticipated sort of generic setting agnostic systems. So I haven't had a chance to play it myself yet, but I was super excited when he said that he was making it last year. It's one of the really cool things that came out of the LGL nonsense. And yeah, definitely go check that out. If you look up Relict RPG on Kickstarter, you will definitely find it.
How do you spell that?
Relict, R-E-L-I-C-T.
Okay. All right. And now, finally, we return to you. And we're going to open the floor and let you plug your project, where we can find it, how long the Backer Kit project is going to be running, where we can go to throw money at you in general. The floor is yours.
Yeah. So my main website is lonecolossusgames.com. I have a web store that's just shop.lonecolossusgames.com, where you can get all of the things that I have previously released via Kickstarter. And I've got stuff on DriveThruRPG if you look up Lone Colossus Games. The other stuff there. The Project Intangible Treasures is going live on Tuesday, March 5th at 9 a.m. Pacific time on BackerKit. If you look up Tome of Intangible Treasures on BackerKit, you'll find it. If you go to my website, it's the first thing on the page. There's a link to it. I am on most social media platforms, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Threads, Blue Sky, at Lone Colossus or at Lone Colossus Games, depending on what the character limit on usernames was.
Right. Yeah, we ran into that too, which is why on Twitter we were at UCT Homebrew, was because Under Common Taste was one character too long.
Yeah,
and I didn't want to be under common tasked. Right. And from the last time you were here, was for Injuries and Vile Deeds. And I meant to let you know that I finally got my copy. And I've got it sitting off screen somewhere. And I love the pin that came with it because I got one of the Fallen Angel pins. And,
yes.
Ooh, nice.
And yeah, the pins turned out really well.
They did. They look real great. Anyway. Josh, thank you so very much for joining us tonight. It's been a blast.
Yes, thank you.
I'm really looking forward to this project. It looks really great, and there are some things in it that I already want to play with. So,
yeah, thanks for having me.
And thank you, everyone, for watching tonight. If you have any comments, suggestions, or ideas, please send us an email, undercommontaste@gmail.com, or come join our Discord and chat with us directly. You can find a link to the Discord in our show notes. We're also going to have a link to the BackerKit page for this project in the show notes. So if you are listening and you just want to check it out real quick, just go down into the show notes and you can find a link there. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Twitch, Blue Sky, Mastodon. I don't interact on all of those platforms nearly as much as I should, but we're there at Under Common Taste on all of those. We are on Patreon, patreon.com/undercommontaste. That's where our write-ups go. I am in the process of doing layout for our poison crafting guide that we've been talking about for the last couple episodes. So look forward to that here in the next week or so. And we are also on Itch, undercommontaste.itch.io. That's where you can find our liminal horror adventure, Beneath the Lake, and my solo journaling RPG, Forever Home. The Solo But Not Alone 4 bundle that game is in finally hit fully funded. So congratulations to that. They hit their $30,000 goal for Take This, and they're still going past. I believe that project runs until March 9th, so there's still a chance to go and pick that up. You get 124 games for $10 or more if you choose to donate more. I have been working my way through the bundle and doing TikTok reviews of all of the games as I finish them. I need to pick up the pace because I'm like 5 games in and the bundle is almost closed. But anyway, yes, go check out all of our stuff.
Yeah. If this is your first time listening to us, welcome. We're glad you found us. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. We're on Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio. Oh, no, we're not on iHeartRadio.
We are.
iTunes. Oh, we're on iHeartRadio?
Yeah, we're on just about everywhere. Everywhere that Podbean distributes to, we're there.
Yeah. So, yeah, please.
Except Pandora, because their requirements are weird.
Yeah, that's wonky. But anyway, please give us a rating and review. This helps increase our visibility and lets us know what you want to hear more of.
Thank you once again, Josh, for coming and joining with us.
Thank you.
Stay safe, and we will see you all in 2 weeks.
Happy gaming.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Under Common Taste. Our theme song is Massacre Anne, written and performed by Mary Kroll and used with permission. You can find Mary online at marykroll.bandcamp.com or on Patreon at patreon.com/drmarycroll. Our logo is by David Sutherland. You can find more of David's work on deviantart.com/David Sutherland or on instagram.com/willx_73. We'll be back in 2 weeks, so stay safe, and we'll see you then.